You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Join WPR for special coverage of the 2023 State of the Union Address tonight at 8 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Now, if you're a home or business owner, you might have heard from Wisconsin's Focus on Energy program about incentives for making your home or facilities more energy efficient. Governor Tony Evers had previously asked for increased funding for the program by way of higher contributions from utilities as part of his 2021-23 budget proposal. Republican state lawmakers pulled that from the budget. It's unclear whether Evers will make a similar proposal this cycle, but increasing energy efficiency statewide is a part of the governor's plan to make Wisconsin's electricity 100% carbon-free by 2050. So how's the Focus on Energy program working in the meantime? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the state's Focus on Energy efficiency program? Have you worked with it, benefited from it maybe as a private citizen or a business owner? Have you made changes to make your home or office more energy efficient? Have you seen an impact on your energy bills? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rebecca Cameron Vock is chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I mentioned people who are familiar with Focus on Energy, asking them to call in. How about for people who haven't? Can you give us the basics on what Focus on Energy is and what it does?
Sure. So Focus on Energy partners with Wisconsin utilities to help homeowners and businesses install cost-effective energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. What's really important, and I've heard this being discussed multiple times over the last few years, and I think that it's a point that is worth clarifying. When we're talking about energy efficiency, we're talking about using less energy to perform the same task in order to produce the same result. So energy efficient homes and buildings will use less energy to heat or cool or run appliances and electronics. And when we look at our manufacturing companies, energy efficient manufacturing facilities, they actually use less energy. So it's important to understand the difference between conservation and energy efficiency. When we talk about conservation, that's relying on people's individual behavior to cut back on their usage. When we're talking about energy efficiency and Focus on Energy in particular, we're talking about ways to harness and utilize technology to help us avoid or reduce energy waste.
Can you give us a couple of examples of the things that Focus on Energy might do, say with homeowners via utilities to help harness that efficiency?
Sure, absolutely. So the first thing that Focus would help you do is they would take an energy assessment of your home. They would send out a trade ally, they would look at the home, they would measure, they would look at the doors. Are you losing a lot of air in between your door jams, in your windows? And then they would offer a range of rebates and services to help you make your home more efficient. So think everything from pipe insulation to Energy Star certified LED light bulbs, high efficiency shower heads, all sorts of products, insulation, air sealing, to help your home retain the energy inside so that it's not leaking energy, so to speak.
And I assume some of those things would apply in a business setting as well. What sorts of unique things for a business, and that can cover a lot of ground, obviously, what kind of specific things for the business world might Focus on Energy do?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, we see just an incredible amount of savings when we look at the business applications, in particular in the manufacturing segment. There are ways and technologies that you can capture the wasted heat that comes off of, think of a very high intensity line where you're producing a product or you're heating metal to a really, really high temperature. You can capture the energy that's coming off from that process, and you can reutilize the energy. But that takes technical expertise. And one of the real important benefits of Focus on Energy is the technical assistance and the technical advisors that they have. So they will work with manufacturing companies, large energy users, and help identify, walk around the facility, look at the shop floor, identifies ways to capture those savings and then run through the numbers to help make it as cost effective as possible.
Rebecca Cameron Bach is with us, chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission, looking at the state's focus on energy, electricity efficiency program, energy efficiency in general, I should say. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences. Have you done something to make your home or business more energy efficient? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Hi, Laura.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm part of Citizen Climate Lobby out of Elkhorn, Wisconsin. And during our meeting last month, we talked about using focus on energy to promote the climate lobby, climate change and everything. And we also, we were talking about having it done, the assessment done. But I understand there may be a cost and it might be significant. Is that true?
Go ahead, Rebecca.
Yeah, thanks for the question. That should not be the case. The assessment should be able to be done at low to no cost. I'm assuming that you've already checked out focusonenergy.com.
I think yes. We do still have Laura. Yeah. So just in general, if somebody is in Laura's position, Rebecca, talk us through how they would seek out this home energy assessment.
So the best place to get started is to learn more by visiting our website, which is focusonenergy.com. And there you'll find a number of resources, particularly the ability to connect with a trade ally in your area of the state. And then you would work with that trade ally to determine what the next steps are.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. Good luck. Rebecca, you've made the case recently that, hey, focus on energy is worth the investment and worth more investment. Republican lawmakers said, you know, the cost comes out of utilities who then pass the cost onto ratepayers. So how do you make the case that investing more is worth it?
So energy efficiency is one of the easiest and most cost-effective ways for us to do a number of things, including combating climate change, reducing energy costs for all consumers, and improving the competitiveness of our U.S. businesses. We also know through a number of studies that energy efficiency is arguably the most important component in achieving net zero emissions of carbon dioxide. For 2021, I can tell you, Rob, that the average residential customer paid about $1.78 per month. And by investing that $1.78 per month, Focus on Energy generated more than $4 in benefits. So what are those benefits? The benefits accrue to every single customer in the state, because we're reducing the kilowatt hours and the therms that are being consumed, which means that the utilities have to go out and procure less of that. By lowering peak demands, we are delaying or eliminating the need for costly grid investments, whether that's building new power plants or that's increasing construction activities that are needed on the distribution system. So it really truly is an investment in the truest sense of the word. And due to the continued success of Focus, Wisconsin homes and businesses have saved nearly 6.3 million megawatt hours since 2007. And to put that in terms that make it a little easier to understand, that is the same amount of generation that we would get from two modern large-scale natural gas plants. And that means real savings for all customers. And I've heard an argument that, well, if we're going to be increasing our investment in focus on energy, that's going to disproportionately impact the lower income communities of our state. And we know that that's not true. Because we know that energy efficiency programs actually improve community resilience, and energy efficiency programs address energy equity by bringing efficient and cost-effective technologies and infrastructure to underserved communities, those in our state, which arguably have some of the most inefficient housing stock.
And you mentioned lower income people, Rebecca. I understand Focus of Energy works with, or the state has an energy assistance program. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So energy assistance is funded through the Department of Administration. And those are federal dollars that are used to help customers pay their energy bills. And certainly energy assistance is an important part of the equation when we're talking about energy burden or affordability of energy bills, but it is only one tool for us to use. Increased energy efficiency will help customers to utilize less energy, which will result in lower energy bills.
Rebecca, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Rebecca Cameron-Vock, chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. We talked to her today about the state's energy efficiency program. It's called Focus on Energy. Coming up, we focus on the cost of heating your home, what drives the prices we pay, and ways you could be more efficient and save money while still staying warm. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen some sticker shock on your heating bills this year or in recent years? Have you done things, whether through Focus on Energy or otherwise, to try to conserve energy, to be more energy efficient, to bring those costs down? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about energy efficiency and turning toward home heating bills this winter. Carl Ebert recently wrote about the topic for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he covers manufacturing, energy, and the new economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed higher heating bills this year? We had a warmer than usual December, I think. Were you happy for some relief? Do you have questions about what goes into the prices we pay? Have you taken steps to pay less by getting more energy efficient, maybe some insulation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
You wrote this piece in January. As I mentioned, we had a milder start for the most part to the winter. What were you starting to look at as we hunkered down in some serious January cold?
Well, you know, that story stemmed from my bill, which had a couple of days of January in it. And I think that people were shocked by the scale of their December bills. Despite the fact that we had a mild winter, fuel costs were sky high in December, and that was reflected in what people paid.
And what's driving that cost in large part? I mean, a lot of us heat with natural gas, of course. What was happening with the price of natural gas?
Yeah, the majority of us heat with natural gas, and gas prices have been very volatile for the past year. You know, it really began with the Ukrainian invasion of Ukraine, but global gas markets have been up and down. And by December, the price of natural gas was about 40% more than it is now.
And when I look, I actually follow natural gas prices some, and sometimes it's like, okay, great. The natural gas price just dropped a lot. That's not immediately reflected in our heating bills, which I guess makes sense. If I'm buying for utility, I'm not going to do like, oh, I'm running a little low on milk, I'll run out to the store today. How far in advance are they making sure they have a supply of natural gas?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that's hard for people to understand. If they do look at spot natural gas prices, there's a place in Louisiana called the Henry Hub, and that's the benchmark for current market prices. And you can see that go up and down and down. And it fell, but the utilities, have a long-term fuel plan, and they need to establish reserves. They need to lock in contracts for the heating season, and then they supplement from the spot market. And this summer, when a lot of that buying happened, the prices were at the highest they've been in 2008, a decade.
Mm-hmm. And you, in your piece, take us deep into our energy bills and a couple lines that up to our total, I guess, per unit of natural gas called a therm, our per therm cost. What's going into that?
What's going into the per therm cost? The utilities are only allowed to bill us what they pay for the gas. The profit on the gas bill shows up in other charges other than the per therm charge. There are connection fees and other associated costs.
And with the fluctuations in price, which part of our heating bill do we see that show up on?
Typically your bill's going to have part of one month and part of the following month. It's not like the billing period ends on the 30th or 31st of the month. So if you look at it and you want to kind of see where the prices are going, that'll show you as two separate lines. And then there is a base rate that you'll see. That was the one that was approved by the Public Service Commission as the very base. And then there's something that shows up as either a PGA or a purchase gas charge. It goes by a variety of names depending upon the utility. And that's what reflects the actual price of gas as it was paid for by the utility.
Talking to Carl Ebert with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at what goes into the price we pay to heat our homes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Craig is with us in Adams. Craig, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I just want to back up and regroup just for a split second to your previous conversation. I'll jump right into the heat.
Sure.
All the new appliances out there are crap, okay? My mom has a kitchen stove, which is a Magic Chef from 1940 that still works. Our new stove lasted a year and a half, and our new fridge, which was a brand name, both, only lasted 3 years. And then you're shopping again. Okay, now to the heat. We had to rebuild our house in 05 due to a fire. It, you know, everything, new house, new furnace, the whole thing. We are on our third motherboard for the furnace. Very, very brand name. Where parts are coming from, I don't care where it's manufactured, because that doesn't mean crap. Where the parts are coming from is not anywhere close to what it used to be.
I gotcha, Craig. Thanks a lot for the call. Carl, I mean, there's been a move toward more energy efficient appliances. I got to say, I haven't had the bad luck. Craig has. Sorry about the house fire too, Craig. Is there this perception out there that energy efficient means shorter lifespans for these appliances? Is that anything you run into as you're researching furnaces?
No, boy, I really can't speak to that. I can from, the energy savings side,
sure,
say that, furnace maintenance is important. Changing filters is important. There are things that you can do. My experience with a relatively new furnace is that I've got a significantly reduced heating bill and great reliability.
Craig, thanks again. Sorry for the bad appliance luck with you. Now, you also look, they say April's the cruelest month, Carl, but you asked the question, is January the worst month for home heating? I guess it kind of makes sense. Is that when we pay our biggest heating bills?
Typically, yes. You know, I mean, the weather's so variable now that it's hard to say. It was 40-some degrees out today. You can't predict it. But historically, when you look at what are called heating degree days, January is the coldest month. It's also one of the longer ones, psychologically as well as on the calendar. You can expect your January bill generally to be higher, but there's no guarantee. You can have a very cold February and the bill comes down.
And then when it comes to energy efficiency, how much control do we have over our own heating bills by doing some of the, focus on energy kind of things we were talking about earlier? Can we bring those numbers down?
Well, yeah, certainly you can. And they're really simple things that you can do. You know, I spoke about, furnace maintenance. That one's maybe a little late in the season to be able to get somebody to do that. But, checking your filters. You can open south-facing windows during the day. That lets the heat in. It can raise the temperature.
The blinds, I should say, not
degrees.
The windows.
Right. Yeah, don't open the windows. I found that I have a house that can be that has cold pockets. I have the fans on in winter, but I've reversed their direction from summer, and it moves the air around and it fills those things in. You know, you can go through your windows, you can identify leaks, make those seals. All those things can make a difference.
And then you also wrote about a couple options for people having trouble paying their bills. We talked a little bit about the low-income heating assistance program earlier. There's also a budget billing that doesn't actually save money, but it does do something. What is that?
What it does is it evens out the peaks and valleys in your annual utility bill. And this is for both heat and for electric. And, you know, in summer, a lot of us are running air conditioners, so the electric bill goes up. If you sign up for budget billing, they look at the average that you've, your average consumption over a fixed period, and then you sign up for 6 months and it gets adjusted. But you have a fixed bill every month that allows you to budget around that.
Carl, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Carl Ebert, business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him today about winter heating bills, how prices are set, and got some ideas on how we can try to save some money on those bills. We also heard earlier from the head of the state's Public Service Commission, Rebecca Cameron Vock, talking about the Focus on Energy program. We'll get a link to the Focus on Energy program, by the way, over at WPR.org/Central Time if you want to check it out and see if it applies to your home or your business. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we protect our rights often in the United States, but do we live up to our responsibilities, our obligations? We'll talk to the author of the new book, The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. We'll continue our series of interviews with the candidates for the open seat on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court, plus a look back at tonight's State of the Union address. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a federal appeals court overturned a federal law that prevents people from owning firearms while under a restraining order for domestic violence. We'll talk to a gun law expert about how a recent Supreme Court ruling is leading to legal challenges like this one. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, four candidates are running for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. We'll start a series of interviews this week by meeting two of those candidates and talking about the biggest issues facing the justices. First, a federal appeals court overturned a federal law last week that prevents people from owning firearms while they are under a restraining order for domestic violence. The court cited a U.S. Supreme Court ruling from last summer that said gun laws should be evaluated based on historical tradition. It's one of the most prominent examples of that landmark Supreme Court ruling changing gun law in the United States. It has legal scholars wondering what could be next. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on this specific case. Do you think the federal government or state or local government should have the ability to say a person can't have a firearm in their possession while they're under a domestic violence restraining order? Do you like that idea? Not like it? Why? Why not? Do you have wider concerns about the way guns are regulated? Recent changes in court rulings on firearms. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law. His work focuses on guns, the Second Amendment, and criminal law. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here, Rob.
Can you tell us a little more about this this court ruling on the domestic violence restraining orders and guns?
Sure. So the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, struck down a decades-old U.S. law that barred domestic abusers from possessing firearms. And in particular, the way the law operated was that it barred gun possession by people who were subject to civil domestic violence restraining orders. And in this case, the defendant, whose name was Zaki Rahimi, assaulted his girlfriend, had agreed to a restraining order that prohibited from possessing firearms, and then was caught with firearms. And when he was prosecuted, he challenged the restriction as unconstitutional. as a violation of the Second Amendment.
Before we get to the grounds for that, this was a federal law. I understand some states have comparable laws, and those are, at least for now, still in effect. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so a lot of states have similar restrictions on firearm possession following domestic violence restraining orders. And those were not immediately affected by this ruling. And in fact, this ruling only is going to govern Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, where the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has jurisdiction. So the rest of the country thus far is not going to be bound or controlled by this decision.
Presumably that may change. It will go to the Supreme Court, and I can imagine challenges to state laws eventually making their way through the federal court system. Is that something you expect to see happen?
Right now, after the Bruin decision from this past June, which really upheaved the way that courts are applying the Second Amendment, we're seeing all gun restrictions, in fact, all weapons restrictions, being challenged as a violation of the Second Amendment. The field of weapons regulation is immense, and we're seeing challenges not only to domestic violence restraining orders, but to restrictions on bringing guns to certain places, the types of weapons that you are allowed to possess, for instance, automatic weapons versus semi-automatic weapons. So we're certainly going to see a lot more litigation around domestic violence restraining orders, and even disqualifying people who are subject to who have been convicted of domestic violence offenses from possessing a firearm. There's going to be a lot of litigation in the coming months and years.
Talking to law professor Eric Rubin from Southern Methodist University about a new court ruling on domestic violence restraining orders and guns and wider issues after a big Supreme Court ruling last summer. And Eric, let's get into that ruling now, the Bruin ruling. The majority in the court gave, in effect, a new standard for how to evaluate firearm regulations under the Second Amendment. What changed?
Sure. So, the specific issue in that case was a century-old regulation in New York State, that said that before you can carry a handgun in public, you need to get a permit. In order to get that permit, you needed to show that you were at a heightened risk of being attacked. It was not a domestic violence restriction, and the court ultimately struck down that restriction. But the reason why that opinion even affected other issues, like domestic violence restrictions on firearm possession, is that, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court said that going forward, courts are going to have to apply a novel test for deciding on the constitutionality of gun laws. In particular, courts have to assess, after Bruin, whether a given restriction is consistent with historical tradition. And to do that, the Supreme Court said that the government has to point to analogous regulations from back in the late 1700s when the Second Amendment was adopted, or maybe into the 1800s. And of course, when it comes to something like domestic violence restraining orders, the government is having a hard time doing that, because back in the late 1700s, our moral compass when it comes to gendered violence was totally different. In fact, it was gendered violence. Domestic violence was viewed as a private matter. There was even something called a right of chastisement, where husbands had the right to discipline their wives and children. So of course, there were no restrictions on gun possession for domestic abusers back then. And that makes it hard for the government to try to analogize to other sorts of things that did exist.
And that late 1700s standard, I mean, most practical firearms at that point had exactly one round at a time, as I understand it. So a law that restricted magazine capacity, would that face the same kind of challenge? Well, there were no such laws in the late 1700s?
Absolutely. There's a big problem of what historians call anachronism. Reading history through a modern day lens, the firearms back in the late 1700s were very different. They were muzzle loaders that were unsafe to keep loaded. So a lot of the historical research on the sorts of crimes and weapons use that happened back then did not involve guns at all. In fact, a lot of crime just happened with whatever was close at hand, not firearms, but knives and blunt force objects and the like. So it was a very different time with respect to technology. Technology's advanced a great deal, but there's also been an incredible amount of social change since then. And When it comes to domestic violence, it's very readily apparent.
Let's bring on a caller. Nancy is with us in Rib Mountain. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I would just like to add to that. Women are not property anymore, even though our legislature is beginning to think we are. And I think if you are arrested for domestic or you are under a restraining order, you have no business holding a firearm. And overall, I'd like to see the 3-day waiting period reinstated just for safety reasons.
Nancy, thanks for the call. Eric, what do you think?
Yes, no, I think that there's no doubt that removing firearms from domestic abusers can prevent homicides. In fact, women are 5 times more likely to die in a domestic violence situation if a gun is present. Every single month, an average of 70 women are shot and killed by an intimate partner. This is one of those areas of gun policy where the empirics all point in one direction. But one of the things that the court said here is that the question, I'm quoting from the opinion. This is the very first sentence. The question presented in this case is not whether prohibiting the possession of firearms by someone subject to a domestic violence restraining order is a laudable policy goal. And then it goes on to say the question is whether or not this is consistent with history or tradition. So the court, in essence, and a lot of courts after Bruin, are basically saying that modern day realities, modern day empirics are not relevant.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. We're talking to Southern Methodist University law professor Eric Rubin about gun laws and a recent court ruling that struck down, at least in one part of the country, a federal firearm ban for people under restraining orders for domestic violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that decision and the Bruin decision we're talking about that says, hey, you want a gun law, you have to find an analogy with something from the late 1700s when the Second Amendment came into effect? Call in with your thoughts, your questions on how this all works at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Eric Rubin, law professor at Southern Methodist University, expert on the Second Amendment. He's with us today to look at the legal implications of a federal appeals court ruling that struck down the law banning gun ownership for people under restraining orders for domestic violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that particular ruling. Also on big changes from the U.S. Supreme Court on the standards that have to be met when it comes to gun laws around the country, saying there has to be an analogy to the late 1700s. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We lost our guest there for a moment, but Eric, we have you back. Are there other cases now you see in the courts right now under Bruin that you're keeping a particularly close eye on that we could see, as you said, a big upheaval?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, there's a lot of litigation going on right now, a lot of litigation. One of the areas of litigation that we're seeing is further refinement of where it's permissible to bar people from carrying guns in public. So after the Bruin decision, which struck down a century-old law in New York as not old enough, the state legislatures in places like New York and New Jersey and California are passing new laws that are saying, okay, well, it's easier to get a permit, but we're going to restrict you from carrying that gun in certain places, like zoos and casinos and beaches and libraries. And a lot of those place-based restrictions are getting struck down. In fact, just last week, a court in New Jersey struck down a restriction on bringing guns into zoos and libraries and casinos and I believe even airports. So there's just a lot of litigation right now. I think people are surprised by the sorts of restrictions that are getting struck down. Another court said that it's unconstitutional and a violation of the Second Amendment to require or to bar the possession of firearms without serial numbers, so-called ghost guns. And the court said, look, there were no serial numbers back in the late 1700s, and there's no requirement for serial numbers, so we can't require them now. So there's, there's differing opinions amongst the courts. There are splits looking at the same historical record and coming out to different conclusions. there's just a lot of litigation, and all around it's a bit of a mess right now.
Yeah, I've seen people say the Bruin ruling in effect makes judges turn into historians in their spare time.
It definitely places a huge emphasis on a different sort of litigation argument than lawyers are used to making and judges are used to seeing. One judge in California asked the parties to submit not briefs, but a spreadsheet with a list of all of the historical laws that might be relevant to the dispute. And that's just not an ordinary form of argumentation that you see in the courts.
Let's bring on another caller now. Margarita is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Margarita, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. For people who have a record of domestic violence that was, among quotations, clear, how is that new law addressing them, you know, as people who have a record of domestic violence and they have a gun or they have guns in their homes?
Margarita, thanks for the call. Yeah, how is that enforced, Eric, or how is that enforced?
Yeah, sure. So, well, one thing with respect to these domestic violence restraining orders, they're temporary restrictions on the possession of firearm. They're not they tend not to just go on to infinity. They're temporary. They're usually for a year or maybe 2 years. And then there are a series of court hearings when the court decides whether or not they should stay in place. Enforcement of these laws is a big problem. And one of the things that happened in this case was that Rahimi, the defendant here, had agreed to a domestic violence restraining order, agreed to give up his gun, and then didn't give up his gun. In fact, he assaulted his girlfriend, which led to the restraining order. But even though he wasn't allowed to have a gun, he later shot several times into the home of a person who he sold drugs. He got in a car accident and then it shot at the other driver. He shot into a law enforcement vehicle. And there were other incidents as well. And so all of this, he should not have had a gun during these incidents because of the domestic violence restraining order. But I think that goes to the point that a lot of the enforcement of this is just that you hope that the threat of a criminal sanction will deter people from possessing firearms.
Thanks for the call, Margarita. Eric, you'd mentioned splits in the courts. I've seen some speculation that there might be some buyer's remorse from some of the members of the U.S. Supreme Court who concurred with this Bruin opinion. Justice Thomas, I think, wrote the majority opinion. There's talk that a couple of the other conservative, quote-unquote, justices might want to dial it back. Do you think there's anything to that?
There might be. It's really difficult to know. The Bruin opinion itself, the majority opinion, all six justices signed onto it. But then there are two concurrences. One of the concurrences was by Justice Brett Kavanaugh. It was joined by Chief Justice John Roberts. And in that concurrence, Kavanaugh made very clear that the ruling does not affect the ability to require permits for the public carrying of firearms, even though, and this went unsaid or unanalyzed, even though permits weren't required for public carry of firearms back in the late 1700s. And also said that the opinion in Bruin didn't call into question some of the sorts of restrictions that the Supreme Court blessed over a decade earlier in a case called Heller. And those restrictions included bars on gun possession by felons and the mentally ill, and bringing firearms into certain sensitive places, even though those restrictions don't have clear historical analogs. So it's possible that even while the Supreme Court imposed this novel test that doesn't apply in other areas of constitutional law, some of the justices are less wedded to it than others. And ultimately, because of these splits, because important laws are getting struck down, the Supreme Court's going to have to get back involved sooner rather than later to provide a bit of clarity.
We'll leave it there. Eric, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. He's with us today for a look at the impact of a ruling by a federal appeals court that overturned in that district a federal law that prohibited people from owning guns while under a restraining order for domestic violence. new survey of students in the University of Wisconsin system has added fuel to the debate over free speech on college campuses, but that debate has been going on for years. Students, professors, and college administrators all face decisions about what speech should be protested and how. Rich Kramer reports.
Days after former Republican President Donald Trump's 2016 victory, conservative commentator Ben Shapiro stepped to the podium in a crowded UW-Madison lecture hall.
Please join me in welcoming Mr. Ben Shapiro.
Shapiro mocked around 20 protesters in the room he deemed social justice warriors. The group responded by periodically interrupting his presentation. The protesters' disruption of the event would become a flashpoint in a national battle over free speech on campus. In 2017, Wisconsin Republicans introduced a bill mandating punishments up to expulsion for UW students who repeatedly disrupt free speech on campus. That legislation never made it to the desk of then-Governor Scott Walker, but the UW System Board of Regents was then made up almost entirely of Republican appointees. They passed a resolution that mirrored some of the bill's language. Former UW System President Ray Cross headed the state's universities at the time.
What I think the Shapiro incident may have triggered is an exposure of one of the flaws that I felt we had in our policy.
Cross says the university does want to protect speakers against what's known as the heckler's veto. That's when the loudest voices are allowed to shut down views they reject. The debate over what free speech on campus should look like is messy. A survey of more than 10,000 UW System students released this month found around half of respondents believed speakers should be disinvited from campus if some find their message offensive. It also found conservative students were more likely to feel pressure to self-censor in class.
I thought that it's at least a good first step.
That's UW-Madison student Jake Rivard. He took the survey. He calls himself a free speech absolutist and chairs the campus chapter of conservative group Young America's Foundation, which invited Shapiro in 2016. Last fall, YAF invited nationally known conservative author Matt Walsh to campus to screen his documentary titled What is a Woman?, which is critical of transgender identity and medical care. Rivard says the event sold out with hundreds more trying to get in.
What it tells me on the surface is that people are interested, at least to hear what he has to say, even if they don't, you know, agree with everything. I don't agree with everything that Matt says, but there's a part of what he says that, you know, I can get behind and I can support.
Ahead of Walsh's event, the student union was vandalized with spray-painted messages calling him a pedophile and Nazi. About 100 protesters rallied outside the event, including PhD candidate Caitlin Benedetto, who argues Walsh's rhetoric ignores growing hostility toward transgender people.
He's signaling and perhaps fomenting even more suspicion and even violence towards trans people.
The protests did not disrupt the event itself. Everyone supports the broad concept of free speech, but sometimes the blinders go on, says Joe Cohn with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE. The national group has represented students, professors, and campus newspapers in lawsuits against university speech policies.
And if we lose the ability to kind of grapple with the uncomfortable conversations, even the ugliness of some views that might be out there in the world, we're going to have a much harder time as a society grappling with those issues when those students become the people in power.
The debate over free speech on campus is far from settled in Wisconsin, and the recent student survey results mark a new chapter as Republican legislators craft the state's next budget. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll start a series of interviews with candidates in the race for Wisconsin's open state Supreme Court seat this year for primary candidates running for two places in the general election. And by the way, join Wisconsin Public Radio tonight at 8 for live coverage of the 2023 State of the Union Address from President Biden and the Republican Response, live hosted coverage from the folks over at NPR. Listen here on Wisconsin Public Radio or online at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.